I'm Marty Moscow-Wain. Welcome to Radio Times. Anti-abortion protesters held a rally last Friday outside of the Planned Parenthood Clinic in Center City, Philadelphia. They were protesting State Representative Brian Sims, who had posted a video of himself taunting and berating a woman and three teenagers who were protesting outside the facility. We asked Representative Sims after this incident to be a guest on Radio Times, but did not hear back from his office. He did tweet, though, "I fiercely protect a woman's right to make the best choices for her health and her body unimpeded," and he promised to do better. Planned Parenthood Pennsylvania CEO Dale Steinberg told WHYY's Billy Penn, "While we do not condone Representative Sims' approach, our patients deserve to have access to health care without shame and stigma." Joining us is Tom Stevens, and he's president and CEO of the Pro-Life Union of Greater Philadelphia. He was at the rally on Friday. Tom Stevens, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks so much for having me. Great to be here.
Nice to have you with us. What did the rally accomplish?
Well, first of all, it brought even more attention to this incredible activity that became known on Monday, Brian Sims taking video of himself, a state representative, harassing first a woman who was just standing there quietly praying, and for 8 minutes there was a video of him harassing this woman and calling her an old white woman and so many other things. And then the second video that became known was of these teenagers and a mom, and the teenagers he doxed. He said, "I'll give anybody $100 if you let me know the identity of those teens." And that just created an outrage across the country. And so this was a coming together, a response to that, just to say, we're not going to back down. We're going to continue to pray in front of abortion centers because it's our right. And we're concerned for women and their babies and fathers. And so it was a national moment. And also, it created opportunity for nationally recognized speakers to come in. And each one, if you watch them on our website, and we invite all your listeners to do that at prolifeunion.org, there were amazing speeches that are just talking about how life begins at conception.
And let me pick up on a couple of things.
Sure.
It seems that your organization and others at the rally want Representative Sims to resign. He has promised to do better. Is that your would that be a definition of success if he were to resign?
So for the father of those three teens, or of two of the teens and their friend, the father would sure like to see him to resign. It would be great if he received some kind of a consequence from his actions, and right now the House of Representatives is calling for some kind of response for him. It's just unacceptable for a public official to act in that way. To us, in some ways, what happens with Representative Sims is much less important than the 4,000 lives that are being lost in the abortion center every year. That's our main concern. That's what's grievous to us as a pro-life community. We care about the unborn, and we care about the women who are going in there and making a decision that will impact the rest of their lives.
Let me pick up on a couple of things, and then we'll certainly talk about some of these abortion bills and laws that are making their way through various states across the country. And I agree with you. I don't think a state representative should be berating or harassing or in any way insulting people who are demonstrating. They certainly have that right to do that. But it's also clear that at a number of these facilities, the people, women going in to have some of these procedures, are harassed and bullied and threatened. Should there be a moratorium on something like that?
I'm not familiar with women being harassed, bullied, or threatened. I haven't witnessed that myself.
I'm looking at a survey. Actually, came from the Feminist Majority Foundation 2018 National Clinic Violence Survey, and they found that something like 52% of clinics reported experiencing targeted threats and intimidation against doctors and staff. How do you feel about that?
So I don't think that anybody should be the recipient of threats and certainly not doctors. So I don't agree with that. I think people should act according to the law and also according to human decency. There is a lot of vitriol around this issue, and it's because people who are concerned about babies are seeing things differently. And so I have seen, of course, and have done it myself, have approached women and handed them a little bag and said, here's a kind note and here's resources for you. We want you to be informed. I think that is our very important duty to be doing that. But I think threats or harassment, that is not acceptable.
This was on a Friday at the rally, and there were women who were going into Planned Parenthood to get some kind of medical services. Were they able to get into the building?
They were. It's a right of way, and pro-life folks are not allowed to be in the way of women going in. And so the police are always gracious and are protecting both sides. And right now, the law allows for abortion, and so we're not allowed to break that law. And so yes, the women, as far as I know, there were women going in that morning, and nobody was had any difficulties getting in.
I'm looking actually at a piece, an op-ed you had in the Philadelphia Inquirer earlier this year, where you write, a human being with unique DNA begins life at the moment of conception. That seems to be what they were saying in Alabama, and that bill was signed into law yesterday. Do you support the Alabama law?
I do. I haven't read through the entire law, but that's the whole point, is that there is a unique human person at the moment of fertilization, and so it's not just about human rights, but it's about the safety of that human person. And I know it's a very difficult issue. There's extremely traumatic or difficult circumstances that people face when there's that unique human person that was unexpected, unplanned. But it's a unique human person.
The law in Alabama, and we should say it is signed, it has not gone into effect and will probably be challenged because of Roe v. Wade, but it essentially, it essentially bans abortion, but also in cases of rape and incest. What's your position on that?
So I agree with that law. And we as an organization, we believe that the sanctity of life trumps the difficult circumstances of life. And, of course, rape is horrific. It's a trauma. And the person who does that deed ought to be prosecuted. And there's a woman who's been traumatized who will perhaps go through years and years and years of her life in need of healing from that experience. But there's still a baby. There's still a human. And there's been victims of rape who've had children and whether given up for adoption or have had those children and cared for them, and those victims are living representatives of the fact that just because somebody is conceived in rape doesn't mean that the lives are ruined.
Well,
so to penalize it's problem. Now, I know that's hard to hear.
It's very hard to hear, and I need to challenge you on this because
sure.
You have, I know you've got five kids. I believe one, maybe two of them are daughters. You are telling us that if your daughter, and I hate to get personal here, but this is such an important issue, that if your daughter was raped and got pregnant, You would force her, even if she didn't want to have this baby, you would force her to carry it to term.
Well, first of all, if my daughter knows that if she ever becomes pregnant, that we will love her no matter what in every circumstance.
But rape is a traumatic event.
If she was raped, first of all, my heart would be broken, utterly broken. But I would never force her to do anything. But if she was younger than 18, I sure would, as a parent, stand up and say, you know what, I hate that this happened to you.
But would you force her to carry the baby to term?
Well, as her dad, I would need to say, daughter, I believe that this is the right thing for you to do in this situation, and I know it's horrific, and I'm sorry.
But would she have the choice? Are you saying that it would be her choice?
Well, my children are free. They're free to obey their father, not obey their father. If they're 18, they're adults, and they can make their own choices. But if she was 16 years old, that would be a very tough time of prayer, a tough time of family life. But I would say, daughter, I think you need to have this baby.
But if she lived in Alabama, and if this law, you know, stays, and it's pretty unclear that it will, but if she were in Alabama, she would not have that choice.
And that might be the best thing. Do you know, Marty, sometimes things that are horrific turn out for the good. And, of course, my faith informs that, but also anybody who's a human would know that sometimes the worst of circumstances bring about good.
You use the word sometimes. I mean, it's not a guarantee.
No, and Marty, life never, there's no guarantees. And we all have to come to a point in our human existence where we come to grips with the fact, is this life worth living? Because there's so many horrible things that happen. And eventually, yet hopefully, we all say, yes, even though I face difficulties that I can't even see yet, yes, my life is worth living. And so is every baby in the womb.
Well, we're going to leave it there. Tom Stevens, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thanks so much for having me, Marty.
You're welcome. And he's the president and CEO of the Pro-Life Union of Greater Philadelphia, and he attended the rally at the Planned Parenthood Clinic in Center City, Philadelphia. We've got two guests who will be joining us as we talk more about some of these anti-abortion laws that are making their way across the country, and they will probably make their way in one form or another to the U.S. Supreme Court. We'll be talking about abortion under attack and the future of Roe v. Wade. Do stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscowen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Yesterday, Alabama Governor Kay Ivey signed the most restrictive anti-abortion law in the country. It essentially bans abortion, even in cases of rape and incest, except when the life of the mother is at stake or the fetus has a fatal anomaly. It also punishes doctors who perform abortions with up to 99 years in prison. Put another way, the doctor who performs an abortion on a teenager who has been raped would get more time than the rapist in Alabama. Alabama is the seventh state this year to pass stricter restrictions on abortion, many of which would be unconstitutional under Roe v. Wade. Supporters say their goal is to overturn the 1973 law. It should be said that Roe v. Wade is still the law of the land in spite of these various bills making their way through the states. Joining us here in our Philadelphia studios is David S. Cohen. He's a professor at Drexel University's Thomas R. Klein School of Law. co-author of a book, in fact, was a guest on Radio Times talking about the book called Living in the Crosshairs, The Untold Stories of Anti-Abortion Terrorism. David S. Cohen, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you very much for having me this morning.
You're very welcome. And joining us from California is Jennifer Conte. She's clinical assistant professor in obstetrics and gynecology at Stanford University, co-host of the Word podcast. And Jennifer Conte, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you again as well. I'm happy to be here.
Happy to have you here, and thanks so much for getting up so early in the morning. David, I know you wanted to comment on the Brian Sims and the video or posting that he did, and also the protest last week in front of the rally. Let me just read an email from Gregory. He says, I've escorted women outside of Planned Parenthood, and protesters do indeed harass women coming into the clinic. But go ahead, your thoughts.
Yeah, I wanted to sort of build on that too. And the protest last week was peaceful, but there were hundreds and hundreds of people out in front of a medical center where people were walking in trying to get care with the dignity that you hope that everyone gets when they get medical care. And that was impossible. I mean, they could get through, but they had about a 2-foot-wide walkway with hundreds of people shouting, not at them, but public protest. That is not the optimal way that we deliver healthcare in this country. It's difficult for people to access. It's intimidating. Even if people aren't yelling specifically at the people, it's intimidating. And that's what women seeking care at Planned Parenthood were facing last week. The other thing is that I think it's important to stress, and you had the quote from Dale Steinberg about her policy from Planned Parenthood. Clinics always advise supporters not to engage with protesters. So what Representative Sims did was an aberration. But nevertheless, he doesn't deserve the death threats he's received, the homophobic slurs, both public and private. That was part of the protests last week, but also privately he's received. That's beyond the line. And he's apologized, or he said it was a mistake and he'll do better. And what he's receiving is not part of normal discourse.
Let me move on to what's happening, I should add, in Pennsylvania, but also in other states as well. And to you, Jennifer Conte, what do you make, as an OBGYN, what do you make of these bills, laws, Alabama, of course, being the most obvious, that are making their way through various courts and various legislatures that essentially would prevent abortion after something like 6 weeks?
I think it's fair to say that this is outrageous and ridiculous. And it's funny because a friend of mine was saying the other day to me, oh, aren't you so shocked about what's happening in Alabama? And unfortunately, I'm not shocked. I think that we sort of saw the writing on the wall when we saw Justice Kennedy retire earlier last year, because we know that the composition of the Supreme Court has so much weight in terms of what will eventually happen to Roe. And so the fact that Alabama, Ohio, Georgia, Kentucky, all of these other states that are, you know, trying to put these early non-medically based gestational age bans in place really is discouraging, but it's not at all surprising. And it's not accidental that this is all happening at once. This is a very strategic, very well thought out plan from the other side to not just ban abortion at 6 weeks, but to essentially put an outright ban on abortion altogether.
Let me pick up on a couple of medical things, and then I'll go back to you, David. To you, Jennifer Conte, we hear about these so-called heartbeat bills that at something like 6 weeks, that after 6 weeks, because of this quote-unquote heartbeat, abortion would become illegal. What is happening at 6 weeks, and what are we hearing from a fetus?
So I want to be clear, too, that when we're talking about a pregnancy or gestation that's 6 weeks, it's technically not a fetus yet. It's still an embryo. And at that point, the fact that you may be able to see cardiac activity, that's a reflection of our technology with the ultrasound that we have right now. When they picked that point, it's not based on any kind of medical knowledge. There's not something medically that happens at 6 weeks that we then decide, like, oh, this means, you know, X, Y, or Z. It is a completely arbitrary point. And again, it's just a means to an end, which is to outright ban abortion altogether. They don't really care that, you know, how far along in the pregnancy one is.
David, I have heard several opponents of abortion say that what we have now is abortion on demand, that essentially at any stage of pregnancy, a woman can receive an abortion. Correct that for us.
Yeah, that's certainly not true. Roe v. Wade is the law of the land. States cannot make abortion illegal throughout pregnancy. But the Supreme Court has given a lot of leeway to states to put a lot of different barriers in the way of people accessing an abortion. And in various parts of the country, especially for poor women of color who live far from urban areas, abortion is legal in theory, but almost inaccessible in reality, because there are mandatory waiting periods. There are gestational bans at 20 weeks, 24 weeks. There are informed consent laws where they're required to get lies from their doctors. Medicaid and sometimes private insurance doesn't cover abortion. So, yeah, there are women in this country for whom accessing abortion pre-viability is easy and accessible. But for a huge number of women, it's really difficult because of the laws in place and the social stigma attached. We are far from a world of abortion on demand right now.
Let me go back to you, Jennifer Conte. And as I understand, and this is from Guttmacher and others, that most abortions take place in that first trimester. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So that if these laws were to go into effect, and David Cohen is going to remind us throughout the hour that they are not in effect now, but if they were to go into effect, it really would affect most women who were seeking an abortion.
That's right. Another thing I like to go back to is not everyone has a normal period. In fact, it's very, very frequent that women will have periods that are not every 28 days. And when we figure out how far along someone is in pregnancy, we base it off of what we call their last menstrual period. And that's based on someone having a 28-day cycle. So if you are someone who has, you know, a 30-day cycle or something that's a variant of normal, you may not even know you're pregnant at that point. And again, that's an intentional move because they're hoping that people won't know they're pregnant. And then by the time they figure it out, it will already be too late.
Let me read something. This is from one of the legislators in Alabama, a guy named Johnston. He says, if this exception was added to the bill, this would be the exception for rape and incest, it would have killed the bill. Whether you were raped or a victim of incest or get pregnant by consent or accident or even artificial insemination, it's still a person. We could not argue to the court with a straight face that it's a person in one instance and not in another. David, this gets us to this whole personhood issue. How do the courts look at something like that?
Well, I think there's some honesty in what that legislator is saying. Because if the position is, as the first guest said, that there's life at the moment of fertilization.
When an egg and a sperm are
joined. Even before implantation, which is the medical definition of pregnancy. But at the moment of fertilization, if that is life, how that life came about should be legally irrelevant. And so the perspective there is saying he's basically saying, that Alabama legislator, is that if we were to argue that you can kill a life using his thinking, if the woman was raped or a victim of incest, then we're not being consistent.
Right.
And I think that's the position he's taking. And, you know, in abstract thinking, I guess there's some honesty there. But I think what he's ignoring is the reality of people's lives. And he's also going far against public opinion. And I think that this extreme bill in Alabama may even work in favor of ultimately saving Roe v. Wade, in this sense that justices who were looking at on the Supreme Court, like Chief Justice Roberts and maybe Justice Kavanaugh, to save Roe, might look at the Alabama law and say, if we get rid of Roe, the parade of horribles that the pro-choice people are saying is not hypothetical. That the reality is there will be states who will say no abortion for anyone. And that might be a really tough pill for Chief Justice Roberts to swallow, at least when I wake up on the optimistic side of the bed. That's what I hope. Because the Alabama law shows just how radical the right-wing anti-abortion movement can get. And that could really scare people like Chief Justice Roberts.
Well, let me play, and then I'll get to you, Jennifer Conte. This is televangelist Pat Robertson describing his hesitance about the Alabama law being tested for the Supreme Court to challenge Roe v. Wade. This is Pat Robertson.
I think Alabama has gone too far. They've passed the law that would give a 99-year prison sentence to people who can commit abortion. There's no exception for rape or incest. It's an extreme law, and they want to challenge Roe versus Wade. But my humble view is that this is not the case we want to bring to the Supreme Court, because I think this one will lose.
Jennifer Conte, when Pat Robertson says this is an extreme law, that says something.
I think that he's sort of hitting on the exact same point that David just mentioned, that we're not talking about abstract thought here. And I think that even someone as, you know, far to the right as him recognizes that when you think about things like rape, incest, or whatever situation you want to insert there, the reality of the situation starts to have a horse in the game, if you want to say. And I, you know, it's in these situations that I think about all the stories of the women that I see go through this. And for example, I recently cared for a woman who is already a mother, mm-hmm. two children at home, and she started feeling pregnant, thought, how could I be pregnant? Because she's got an IUD in place, which is the most, you know, effective contraception we have. Turns out she is pregnant. And when she, you know, had the ultrasound done, the pregnancy was about 6.5 weeks along. So it would have been too far along for one of these states. But her IUD had perforated through and gone through the backside of her uterus. It's a very rare thing, but it does happen. And this is an example of one of these realistic or reality situations wherein if you apply a one-size-fits-all law like this, you're sort of ignoring the reality of people's lives, and especially situations like this where this woman was doing everything she was supposed to be doing to not get pregnant again.
Would some of these laws essentially ban the use of IUDs, Jennifer?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, too. I think that they posed that to the legislator out of Ohio, who also made that ridiculous comment about ectopic pregnancies being able to be transplanted back into the uterus. And he made a comment that he didn't really understand, that wasn't necessarily his area of expertise, but that presumably they would, which is ridiculous because IUDs or contraceptive methods like that are not abortifacients. They're completely different things. I think this really drives home the point that legislators are not medical professionals. And when we rely on them to make decisions about women's health, we get into a lot of sticky and awful situations like this because there's a lot of nuances that they just don't have the educational background to navigate.
And I'm looking at, this is Representative John Becker, Republican of Ohio, mm-hmm. And he's basically saying that, and I'm going to quote him, a procedure for an ectopic pregnancy that is intended to reimplant the fertilized ovum into the pregnant woman's uterus. He's saying basically we would take it out of what, the fallopian tubes, and then implant this in a woman's uterus?
Ridiculous. It's a ridiculous.
Does it even exist? I mean, is that?
No, it doesn't. And someone had shown me, I guess, the article that he was referencing, which is this case report, if you will, or this physician in 1917 wrote up a report of one person that he had potentially tried this on. And I asked then, what other medical condition ever do you want your physician, you know, quoting data from 1917 to treat? Right. It's just ridiculous. It's not an actual procedure. That is never something that we could do for an ectopic. I find it ridiculous that I'm even entertaining the, you know.
I just had to ask you the question just to set things straight. Let me read a couple of comments. One from Doris on our Facebook. Personally, I believe abortion is a sin, but I do not want my religious beliefs to be legislated. A Facebook comment from Gail Marie. I am horrified at the laws being enacted, and I'm furious that all male legislatures are passing these laws. Another comment from Facebook. This is Mike. I honestly think that if men got pregnant, we see a totally different result and way of thinking. David, let me go back to you. There are a number of these laws, or I guess laws, bills in the pipeline on their way to the U.S. Supreme Court. Do we know what's in that pipeline?
Yeah. So this is the interesting thing about the attention that's being paid to these 6-week bans and the Alabama ban. They are probably going to be irrelevant in the long term. They're not going to take effect because, first of all, on their face, they don't take effect for 6 months or even a year. They will be challenged in court. And the people challenging will win in every court until the Supreme Court, but that'll take years. Even the most conservative judge will strike these laws down as unconstitutional. We've seen that before. In the meantime, the Supreme Court is considering several possible abortion-related cases. There are two out of Indiana involving a Down syndrome ban, involving an 18-hour waiting period with an ultrasound requirement, two different cases. There's one out of Alabama involving ban on the most common form of second trimester abortion. all three of those cases, plus a Louisiana case that could be before the court soon, the Supreme Court is considering whether to take those cases. In any one of those cases, even though those restrictions are not as crazy as these six-week or Alabama bans, in any one of those cases, the Supreme Court, if it takes those cases, will tell us what this newly constituted Supreme Court is thinking about abortion. It could use one of those cases to overturn Roe, even though it's a different issue. It could use those to overturn Roe. Even if it doesn't do that, it could tell us we think the precedent needs to be followed or we think the precedent needs to be chipped away. We are going to find out what this court thinks about Roe long before the Ohio, Georgia, or Alabama cases come to it. So when those cases eventually make their way, we will already be down a path. Or we won't,
right.
But those cases aren't going to change it. These cases are getting a lot of attention. I mean, these laws are getting a lot of attention, and they should. They deserve it. The outrage is justified, and we need to mobilize around these laws. But as a constitutional matter around Roe v. Wade, the cases are already being considered by the Supreme Court, whether they are going to take them, and those are the ones we need to pay attention to.
Jennifer Ramos, I'm going to break. Anything you want to add to that?
No, I think it's a really fair point. And I think that when you try to make a guess about what's going to happen, I think you're absolutely right, David, that the D&E ban or the ban at abortion, the most common procedure that we do in the second trimester, I think is a really more plausible hit. And that would also be devastating for women.
Let's take that short break and we'll get back to our conversation. That's Jennifer Conte. She's clinical assistant professor in obstetrics and gynecology at Stanford University, co-host of the V Word podcast, joining us, I believe, from the studios of Stanford University. Got up early in the morning to join us on Radio Times. And here with us in our Philadelphia studios is David S. Cohen. He's professor at Drexel University's Thomas R. Klein School of Law, co-author of Living in the Crosshairs, The Untold Stories of Anti-Abortion Terrorism. He's got a new book written with Carol Jaffe out next year called Obstacle Course, The Everyday Struggles to Get an Abortion in America. You can join us 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, talking with our guests about the passage of the strictest anti-abortion law in the country in Alabama, what it could mean for Roe v. Wade and the right to an abortion. And again, you can join our conversation, 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. I do want to play a clip, and this is about a minute and a half. This is Alabama State Senator Vivian Davis Figures, and she is challenging State Senator and the sponsor of this anti-abortion bill in Alabama, Clyde Chambliss, on the Senate floor, and this is from May 14th.
Do you know what it's like to be raped?
No, ma'am, I don't.
Do you know what it's like to have a relative commit incest on you?
On me? No, ma'am.
Yes, on you. Okay. So that's one of those traumas that a person experiences, just like that child experienced. And to take that choice away from that person who had such a traumatic act committed against them, to be left with the residue of that person, if you will, to have to bring that child into this world and be reminded of that every single day. Some people can do that. You know, some people can, but some can't.
Sure.
So, but why would you not want a woman to at least have that exception for such a horrific act?
Because I believe that when that unborn child becomes a person, and we need legal guidance on when that is.
But that's not your business. That is not your business. You don't have to raise that child. You don't have to carry that child. You don't have to provide for that child. You don't have to do anything for that child. But yet, you want to make the decision for that woman that that's what she has to do.
Jennifer Conte, a very passionate argument against this bill, but also supporting this provision of making sure that if you're raped or the victim of incest in Alabama, that you will be protected, and yet it didn't pass.
It's insane. It's insane, and I think that it speaks to the fact that you can, I mean, as that gentleman, says, you can believe a certain thing, but I think that this comes down to, what do you value more? Do you value the life of the woman, the well-being of the woman who is living and who is going through this struggle, or the potential life? So actual life versus potential life.
What do you think, David?
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree. I think that the position that the legislators in Alabama are taking is one that is so far out of step with American thought. And I don't think public opinion polls should always dictate policy, but the majority of people have supported legal abortion ever since Roe v. Wade was decided, and a vast majority support rape and incest exceptions because they have the compassion to understand the trauma that one legislator was talking about and trying to get the other to think about. They have the compassion to think that, at the very least, in these circumstances, we can't put a pregnant person through this. And so what this legislator is doing, or what the legislature in Alabama did, is so extreme, so out of step with American thought. It's really risky.
I want to talk a bit about an article you had in the Washington Post, David. Supporters of abortion rights should be energized, not demoralized. And obviously a lot of focus on these various states, including Alabama. But you're saying don't forget what's happening in other states.
Yeah, the story about abortion in America in 2019 is not only Alabama, Georgia, Kentucky, and Ohio. There's some really amazing things going on in other states that are really losing the focus. Just this week, the Maine Senate passed a law which would expand Medicaid to cover abortions. It had already been passed by the House. The governor of Maine has said she will sign it. It needs to go through one other procedural hurdle, but we should see that enacted sometime later this year. That will expand access in that state greatly. The Supreme Courts of Montana and Kansas have both issued resounding opinions in favor of abortion rights just in the past few weeks. In Kansas, striking down the second trimester method ban that we talked about earlier and finding a right in the Kansas Constitution to abortion. That's a monumental decision. The Montana Supreme Court struck down a restriction on non-doctors, so advanced practice clinicians, nurses, midwives, physicians' assistants, performing abortion. So Montana access is going to increase as a result of that. We're also seeing cities across the country doing positive things around abortion. The story is not only a story of extremism. That's an important story to pay attention to, and it upsets everyone who cares about these issues tremendously. But there are some incredible things going on right now, not just in liberal blue states, but across the country. And I think that these are things that could serve for the model when we come out of this period of the extremism, and we could see a path forward eventually. There's good news going on.
But is the path forward that states will essentially decide laws for themselves and restrictions for themselves?
So right now, that might be the path forward, that we can see some recourse in state Supreme Courts if the U.S. Supreme Court is not going to be favorable to the right of abortion, that state Supreme Courts and state legislatures will be able to protect and expand access for people in need, especially if there are problems in other states. But I think also seeing policy in states bubble up and become national policy so that more states follow what Maine is doing and expand Medicaid access. And eventually there's a bill in Congress that people are pushing now. And maybe if the Democrats take control of both the House and the Senate, they will make it a nationwide law that Medicaid has to cover abortion. That would expand access to millions of women in a way that would radically change abortion in this country.
How do you see that, Jennifer Conte?
I agree. I think the only hesitancy I have is that when we've seen really great laws passed recently, so for example, in New York, the New York Reproductive Health Act, or what they were doing in Virginia, something similar, where they are essentially trying to protect the right to abortion for women should the federal precedent fall. You see this, the media and the anti-choice side really twist that and make it a negative story. So I think it's sort of hard to celebrate these wins, if you will, because of the current political atmosphere. But I agree that there are certainly several states that are working hard to protect the rights of women should and when this happen.
Jennifer, let me go back to you. And there is a bill under consideration in the Pennsylvania legislature that would essentially ban abortions if there's a diagnosis of Down's syndrome. What do you make of that? And how common is something like that? Do we even know?
I think that this is it doesn't matter necessarily why they're trying to ban it, because it sort of goes back to the general umbrella of anti-choice or restrictive abortion laws. It sort of doesn't matter if it's for one particular genetic diagnosis or one particular gestational age, or if they're doing it because of what we're calling trap laws or targeted regulation of abortion providers, where in order to perform an abortion, your hallway needs to be a certain length or you need to have the proper OR lighting or whatever. It doesn't matter. The end message is the same, is that politicians are trying to play doctor, essentially, and are trying to manage the reproductive health care of women. And we know that that is dangerous, regardless of, you know, what law they're trying to enact.
Are you concerned that some miscarriages could be viewed as some attempt at abortion?
It is something that's come up, especially with the Georgia law, where you know, in sort of proposing this legislation, they're worried that should a woman miscarry and someone suspects that she did something to cause that miscarriage, could they prosecute her? And I'll say from a medical perspective that an early miscarriage and an early medication abortion, if you were to use, you know, the medications mifepristone and misoprostol, they look exactly the same. You can't really tell. So I think that this puts us in a very dangerous place where women essentially are going to almost have to try to prove that they miscarried, which is tragic, because miscarriage in general is very tragic. It's not something that, one, you cause in any way. It usually has to do with the chromosomal composition of the embryo. And two, that we're essentially trying to put fault on someone for miscarrying is again, horrific.
Let me read some more comments. One from Sheila: if this does not unite women, I don't know what will. Facebook comment from Evan: Republicans don't care about this issue. They just want to throw their most steadfast voters a bone. Folks who believe deeply in the pro-life movement are just being had. An email from Larry: I'm a far left Democrat, and I agree that this is a hard concept to accept because the consequences are so intense. But the baby did not make any choices, so give the baby the benefit of the doubt. Betty said, I want to know the voting record of the politicians who voted for this bill on things like child care. Do they care about the child after it's born? Can I toss that to you, David?
Yeah, I think we're seeing that here in Pennsylvania with the Down syndrome law that's moving through the legislature. We see a legislature that has not increased support for parents who have kids who have Down syndrome or any other physical or other disability. These legislatures are not showing that they are, quote unquote, pro-life in any way having to do with children that exist in the world. If they did, they would have a very different policy. They would support pregnant women in very different ways. They would support parenting women and men in very different ways. And we don't see that. What we see is again and again attacking people who are pregnant and saying you have one option and one option only, and that is to carry the pregnancy to term no matter the risk to your mental or physical health or your long-term interest in having the life you want to live. You are going to carry that to term no matter what. And that is not pro-life. That is anti-woman. That is anti-pregnant person. That is anti-health. And that's what we're seeing.
Donald Trump said, I believe when he was campaigning, asked about abortion, he said, and I'm quoting here, you have to ban it. There has to be some form of punishment. I'm not sure if he was talking about punishment for women or punishment for doctors. And he essentially promised to, I guess, to overturn Roe v. Wade. Your thoughts, David? And for you, Jennifer, as well, but go ahead, David.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen him take the steps that a president can take in terms of appointing justices to the Supreme Court that he believes might walk down that path going forward. He can't overturn Roe himself, but he can enact policies such as banning support for foreign aid in other countries where agencies refer to or counsel about abortion, and he's done that. But this idea of punishment of pregnant people and not just the doctors, punishing the women who miscarry or something else, we've seen that. I mean, we've seen prosecutions in this country for women who miscarry or who deliver, but there's a problem with delivery and they don't immediately go to the doctor. We've seen that around the country. We had a mom here in Pennsylvania several years ago who was prosecuted for getting her daughter, her teenage daughter, the drugs that Jennifer was just talking about, and giving them to her daughter. Her daughter was totally fine, but she was prosecuted for child endangerment. So I think when Donald Trump talks about punishment, he's not just talking about punishing the medical professionals involved, but also punishing the women. These laws do not exclude that, no matter how much the legislators say they don't want that. Some do, some don't. But these laws open up that door.
Jennifer, your thoughts. And I'm also curious about medical schools. Do they teach abortion in medical school?
So two things. To answer the last question, it is a changing landscape. And I think more and more people are, not only in medical schools, but especially in OBGYN residencies, adapting more of an opt-out process, which is where the opportunity is provided. And if you object for moral or religious objection, then you can sort of opt out of that experience, whereas it used to be the opposite. But getting back to the idea of punishment, I'm glad you brought that up, because the alternative to a lot of these restrictive laws is not that women will stop having abortions. I'm shocked that legislators think that if they just put these laws into place, women will stop having abortions. Because we know from, you know, international examples of countries all over the world, South Africa, parts of South America, that when you make the laws more restrictive, the maternal mortality, which includes women who are pregnant or having abortions, rather, because they're pregnant, goes up dramatically. And the opposite is true for when you make more liberal laws. Safety goes up and the number of abortions also goes down. So if you enforce this idea of punishment, but then also don't acknowledge that women will find other routes. And what I mean by that is self-managed abortion, like David was saying, people sourcing these medications by themselves through the internet or their local bodega, whatever. You're sort of ignoring the reality that people will do this anyway, and they'll find other ways to be punished for it.
Jennifer, we're almost out of time here, but I scribbled the word contraception, which we haven't talked about. Is there, do you think, some kind of middle ground where there can be some agreement about more access to contraception?
I would love for people to adopt that mindset. It only makes sense that if you are going to try to limit abortion, you would also try to increase access to contraception. That makes sense. But unfortunately, we don't see that happening, because at the end of the day, this was never about the fetus. This is about controlling women's reproductive rights.
David, your final thoughts?
Yeah, no matter how widely accessible contraception is, contraception fails for reasons having to do with the contraception itself and the people using it. And there's also people who intend to get pregnant, and then something happens in their life or the pregnancy. Abortion is always going to be needed, no matter how much contraception there is. It needs to be accessible. It needs to be available. And these laws are just going to restrict that and burden people.
David S. Cohen, thank you for coming in and joining us on Radio Times.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're welcome. Professor, Drexel University's Thomas R. Klein School of Law. Jennifer Conte, thank you again for getting up so early and joining us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Clinical Assistant Professor in Obstetrics and Gynecology at Stanford University, co-host of the V Word podcast. And we began our conversation with Tom Stevens, and he is President and CEO of the Philadelphia Pro-Life Union. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about the program, including how to download a podcast of the show. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you for joining us.